From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for joining us for the weekly wrap-up of Connections on WXXI Radio. We appreciate you joining us. We'll open this week's podcast with one of the most powerful conversations we've ever had on the talk show. We'll get right to it. It's about one family's personal struggle with institutional racism and how it shaped their lives for generations. Local activist Miriam Zinter says she was waiting for church to start one Sunday recently when she decided to tweet about her father's experience with institutional racism. Her thread went super nuclear viral. Miriam joined us on the talk show to talk through that thread. In this clip, she talks about how her African-American father, who always had an interest in electrical engineering, decided to enlist in the Navy. He thought he'd have access to education and a range of other opportunities. We'll let Miriam tell you the rest of that story.
So my dad was talked into it and was told that, yeah, he could join the electrical engineering group and learn all about electrical engineering and technology. So he signed up. And when he got on the ship, he was told, silly Negro, you can't be part of the engineering group. You have three choices. You can be a cook. You can swab the deck, be a custodian. I think from what I've learned, there was also a valet where you could basically butler to an officer, or you could scrape the barnacles and repaint the side of the ship. And so my dad took the barnacles. But he soon developed a reputation on the ship for being able to fix anything. So all the sailors would bring to him their broken electronics, and my dad could fix things. And he's always been really good at analytical thinking. And so from what he says, this story, that the radar went down on the ship and the group was there. They were trying everything. They were trying to figure it out. And finally, they were so frustrated and angry. It was going on day three. And one of the guys said, well, there's a Negro on board and he seems to be able to fix anything. Do you want me to get him? And the guy who was head of the electrical engineering program said, I don't care if he's purple, yellow, or pink. Go get somebody. And so they got my dad. And my dad said that when they put him, it was in a little room, he said. And he said it was like God directed his hand. He said he could never take credit for what happened. But for some reason, his hands just ended up on a fuse. And it was this fuse that had screwed up the system. So he replaced the fuse and the radar came back up. And when he came out of the room, the head of the engineering program said, why aren't you in my program? And he said, well, I've been told Negroes aren't allowed in your program, sir. And that changed. And so my dad got to be in the program. He said it took him a lot longer. And when he got in, other people had been in for a while, but he was so happy to be in that program. And he ended up coming out of the Navy and really wanting to get a job in electricity as an electrical engineer. But at first, he could really only get a job as a janitor. And then, you know, he met my mom and married my mom and they had me. And just like everybody, they wanted to have a house. And when they went to...
This was when, by the way?
I was born in 1964. So I think about 2 years later, 1966. So after the Civil Rights Act, he went to the banks and said, I'm a veteran. I'm interested in getting a VA loan. And we're interested in this house. And he was told, well, there's a deed restriction. We're sorry, but that house can't be sold to Negroes. We would love to give you a loan, but we can't because of that deed restriction. But every house had that deed restriction. And so any Black person who went and wanted to get a bank loan couldn't because there was deed language that prevented them from owning that property. So my dad found out about an opportunity in Alaska. He was mad, by the way, that I revealed that he did some work for the Navy there. So, but he went to Alaska for a year.
Well, the cat's out of the bag.
I know. It was like, you what? So my mom and I moved in with his mother, my grandmother, and we shared a room. And my dad worked up in Alaska for a year. They provided room and board, and they paid a premium. He made $50,000 in 1966 for doing that. I think actually I was 18 months old. And he sent every penny home to my mom. She banked it. And when he came back, they found a builder to build them a house. because that house would have no deed restriction. And my father paid the builder, Mr. Oot, in Liverpool. It's now called The Meadows, but then it was called Oot Meadows. And Mr. Oot built my parents a house, and we moved in. And that year, 1968, I went to kindergarten in Liverpool, New York, and I was the first Black student to go to Nate Perry Elementary School.
Amazing stuff. Did you get a sense, talking to your dad, that how did he react, as far as you know, to being told, because he goes to the Navy, thinking, I can use my skills for this, and he was told that we don't put Black people in those programs. You can clean barnacles. Did he tell you what that was like?
He didn't say in so many words. I was very quiet because it was the first time he was talking about it. One of the things he did say was that there was one naval officer who was incredibly racist and used to do horrible things to the Black sailors. After the kitchen was cleaned, he would dump all the garbage on the floor, make them crawl through it, do awful things. But for him, you know, that one awful racist officer, there was also the guy who ran the engineering program, who did his best to make sure that my dad got all the knowledge that he needed. So, you know, you have two opposite ends of the spectrum. Somebody who's in a position of power, who uses that power to subjugate his fellow man, and somebody who's in a position of power, who uses that power to elevate his fellow man. And so my dad had a lot of feelings about the Navy, good and bad, but that was the first and only time he ever shared it with me. And I thought about it, you know, and my mind would continuously go to what he went through and what he endured, and you know, how he just happened to have this talent with electrical things, and how he got the reputation, and how he happened to be in that position. But it also makes me think of all of the people who don't necessarily have an electrical talent, or who don't happen to be called to be in the right place, or who don't have somebody who sees beyond their skin color and allows them to be the best person they can be.
And there's more from Miriam, a whole hour's worth. So we strongly recommend you listening to that entire show with Miriam Zinter. You can find it on our website, wxxinews.org/connections. Next, another powerful conversation. And this one sheds light on how police community relations can change. The Irondequoit Police Department is hosting a community relations forum in the hopes of improving relations and communication with residents. One of the forum organizers is Reverend Patricia Freeman. She admitted that she used to be suspicious of police officers, but that changed. And while it doesn't mean that she excuses police brutality when it happens, it does mean that she sees police in a more human light. Here's how she says things changed.
I became friends with a police officer. You know, we got together because he was running a local program in my community with the kids. And I was a youth pastor, and we just became friends. And then I realized, you know, he has the same desire as I do. You know, when he walks his beat, he wants to come home safe. When I'm at a church, I want to come home safe. He wants not just for himself to be safe, but his family, his neighbors. And when we bond over our commonality, we tend to have not just better communities, but we have a better police force because we start seeing them, as I said earlier, as human beings. And we all make mistakes. God, I have made some of my own mistakes.
Boy, me too.
But I don't let the mistakes that I made dictate where I'm going to go. I use it to improve. And so that's what the police department is trying to do. And this is what we're trying to do with this forum.
And Reverend, have you had people you minister to say, don't sell out for them? Why do you trust them?
Yes. As an African-American woman, I am well acquainted with the problems that we have with policing regarding people of color. I know about the shootings. I know what there are many different things that shape what an officer does in that moment. I'm not in that moment, but I can understand that. And I can still understand that and still call right is right and wrong is wrong. And when you do something wrong, you have to be held accountable. And for our police officers, their accountability is not just to the force, but it is to the community. And we need to stand up when we see something wrong and speak about it. You know, I'm in the Black church, so we're talking about being prophetic. And that means giving voice to those who, for whatever reason, do not have a voice. And so I think it's important that we keep our police officers accountable, but we as a community need to be accountable to them. And one of the ways we are accountable to them is to speak up. Speak up when something is right and speak up when something is wrong. Early on in my ministry, I was kind of reluctant. I was a youth pastor and I was kind of reluctant to involve the police in certain situations. But then I had to realize that we are not just accountable to each other, but we're accountable to the communities that we represent as people. And you may be reluctant, but then you can always go to a shareholder in the community that will come with you. There is power in the number of voices. So when you gather your voice with someone else to address what is going on in your community, particularly with the police, it makes an impact. Because you may represent yourself, who may be reluctant to go, but you're also speaking for other people to let the police officers know why you're reluctant. We can't just be reluctant and not come. That's not part of being operating as a civic community.
We'll end the week with a conversation about words. Merriam-Webster added 840 new words to its dictionary this month. And as we do from time to time on the show, we invited a group of people to test their knowledge of these words with a fun quiz. You can hear that in the podcast. And we had that conversation over guac and margs because we are super hangry. But we also talked about some serious issues related to language. So this clip is a conversation about privilege and how some words wind up in the dictionary before others. Here's Amanda Chestnut, artist and communications coordinator for the Flower City Arts Center.
I think that what winds up in the dictionary can sometimes be an example of privilege in a sense, because some of the words that you listed have actually been in use for 10, 15, 20 years even.
Yeah.
So having them being adopted by a certain group of people is the thing that makes them actually move into the dictionary. So I do think that it's important that they wind up there. But I think that that place in the dictionary is also a point of privilege in and of itself, because there are lots of words that don't wind up making that cut that are very they're very specific to subcultures, to cultural groups that use them very regularly, often for many years, and they don't make it into the popular lexicon, and therefore they don't make it into the dictionary. And in some ways, that's a little bit of a loss culturally.
Yeah, a loss and probably a reinforcement of privilege and advantage, because when we talk about so-called professional standards, whether it's hair or language, words, patterns of speaking, actual vocabulary, for a long time in this country, been white people making the rules. So white people slang can get in there pretty easily. But yeah, I take that point. Though I wonder if that's starting to change. Do you feel any sort of current of change with that? More respect for, as you say, subcultures and language and ideas?
I think just looking at the list of words that were let in most recently in 2018 would be a great example of that. Harassa was on the list. That's a thing that's been around for a very, very long time, and it's just being admitted into the dictionary. Latinx is on the list, mm-hmm. which is a non-gendered form of Latino or Latina. Again, that's something that's been in use by a lot of people, especially in particular cultural subsets, for quite some time. So I do think that there is maybe a trend towards inclusivity, but I don't know if that's necessarily on the part of the dictionary or if it's because we're doing a better job of writing and reading each other's writing. So these words are becoming more prevalent in a wider audience. With social media being what it is, it might just be that they're the words like Latinx. If you have more friends who are Latinx on Facebook, you're going to see that word more often.
Yeah.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also find us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will talk to you Monday.